This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Staughton Lind. He's the author of a book called Accompanying, Pathways to Social Change. How are you, Staughton?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm really glad to have you here. And this is a book that I think that I would characterize it as a small book, but with a lot of content, where you're really kind of tracking your own history as an organizer, as a political person, and using that as a structure to talk about a different way of organizing, and in some ways a critique of the structural way that political change has occurred over the last 50 years or so. I'm kind of interested in, maybe you could talk about a little bit more about what you mean by accompaniment in this context versus kind of traditional organizing.
Okay. I think that the word organizing was very popular in the 60s from the trade union movement through the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement. But as we all know, important organizations of the 60s like SDS and SNCC crashed and burned at the end of that decade. And now we're confronted with something similar with the trade union movement, which has shrunk to a pale imitation of its former self. And I connect these dots. I think that the paradigm, the model of even the best social activity in the 60s was a trade union conception of organizing where someone who was not part of a community came to that community for what, at least in historical retrospect, was an awfully brief time. The Summer Project in Mississippi in 1964 actually lasted only about 6 weeks. And the most dedicated organizers, like Stokely Carmichael of SNCC when he moved to Lowndes County, Alabama, and developed the Black Panther Party there in 1965, 1966, stayed less than 2 years. And my thesis is that this kind of organizing tends not to leave permanent results. And I contrast it with what I call accompaniment, a word that I think describes a widespread practice in Latin America growing out of liberation theology, but which may have first been articulated by my favorite contemporary saint, Archbishop Romero of El Salvador. And the point about accompaniment is that if you're distressed about some social situation, that of African Americans in the Deep South in the 60s, that of Haitians or Palestinians today, and you want to be helpful, two things. One, be prepared to stay there for a significant length of time. Two, and this grows out of the experience of my wife and myself, if there's a way to make it possible, bring with you a skill that people really need. Whether you are a doctor or a teacher or a minister or what you may be, if you bring something that people need, It's extraordinary the degree to which that can lead to forgiveness of any particular sins in your social background or past activity. My wife and I moved to the Youngstown, Ohio area where we still live in 1976. And it's just crystal clear that it was the fact we came as lawyers with something to offer first trade unionists and then prisoners that has accounted for whatever success we've achieved while here. So that's a sketch of the argument in the book. Set aside the model of organizing, even if practiced by people you love, like those in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and think instead of accompaniment, of a commitment to a particular commitment, a particular community and group of people that will last for years.
So I guess I think when you describe it that way, and I read the book that way, that you're really talking to people who do want to make social change.
That's right.
And you're trying to overcome, in a sense, people model their behavior on structures that they've learned.
Precisely.
And what we've learned is often what I would call command and control. It's hierarchical, militaristic forms of structures, and that you describe that what happened, the way that trade unions were organized, even were somewhat were very much in that way. That even though they might have started as a mass movement, with lots of people in their experience of the experience being part of the uprising, let's say, they quickly form into social structures, political structures, organizing structures that are simply hierarchical. It's almost as, when you think about feminist critiques of patriarchal society, that's what they're talking about. All of these structures are purely hierarchical.
Yes, and just to make that a little more concrete, I think that there is understandably a widespread debate about the decline of trade unionism in the United States, and everybody has their favorite villain. From the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 to President Reagan's suppression of the PATCO strike. But I go back to the very first collective bargaining agreements between the CIO, a project managed from above by John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers, and initially the General Motors Corporation, and a second corporation with, I believe, a somewhat overlapping board of directors with GM, namely U.S. Steel. And I think the critical elements of that prototype, that typical CIO contract, are two. First, a so-called management rights clause, which gives the company the exclusive unilateral right to make all the big decisions about investment, including closing plants, as in Youngstown. And then secondly, a no-strike clause, which, to lapse into the colloquial, prevents workers from doing anything about decisions made pursuant to the management rights part of the contract. And I vividly remember an experience in the summer of 1980 Every steel mill in Youngstown had ceased production. Not one ton of steel was being rolled in a community that had once been the second or third largest steel producing area of the country. And I happened to wander into what had been the local union headquarters of Local 1330 of the United Steelworkers. The glass on the front doors was broken. The place was disintegrating. And the president of the local union, Bob Vasquez, was cleaning out his files. And he looked up as he came in and he said, "Hello, Staunton. I understand you're a historian." And he gave me several typewritten drafts of the first contract between U.S. Steel and the Steelworkers Organizing Committee of the CIO. And lo and behold, these were very short documents, every one of them had in identical language a management rights clause that was virtually the same as that in the existing contract 40 years later when the mills closed. And my reflection on that is that understandably the infant CIO sought to present itself as a respectable partner to the business community, but in doing so, it gave away a critical area of decision making. No one supposed in 1937 that any of these mills could ever close. And now, in a community like Youngstown, they've all closed, and the contract clause that we thought so innocuous back in the 30s was the instrument that prevented us from doing anything about it.
Well, I sort of want to talk about that a little bit. It seems to me that that reflects a kind of practicality on both sides at that time. Let's go, that what the owners of the companies wanted was to be able to run their companies and accommodate the needs of their workers to the minimal amount possible, essentially co-opting them if they could. And that what they focused on was, well, we'll give you more money and we'll give you some rights, but we're not going to give you anything that would upset the actual structure of our business. Your workers, we're the bosses, it's our business, we're going to make the decisions, you're going to do the work.
You got it.
And that was a conversation, if you will, between two sides. And the other side said, and they kind of gave away the whatever revolutionary or structurally challenging goals they had. And probably, I'm sure there was a lot of differentiation in the membership of the union at that time. Some of them, all a lot of people really just wanted a better life. They wanted a little bit more money or and some job security.
It's absolutely right.
Right. So what we have in the end is, if we want to, nobody ever wants to talk about capitalism anymore, but
Except I do.
well, a few people do. And but what we have is capitalism absorbing and kind of reinterpreting itself in order to continue without being altered. And the structural, no structural change really occurred.
And I think that's right. And let me mention one other, perhaps slightly more subtle dimension of it, that I think the union movement, the CIO, this new structure that so many people sacrifice so much for, tended to view the motivation of its membership very narrowly. That is to say, what you really want is job security, a decent wage, the prospect of a secure retirement with health care. And if we can give you those things as an individual, that's all you really want to make you happy. And let me give you an example of how I think that didn't work. It is often said that the CIO's signature achievement was the seniority system. And I've spoken to people in Youngstown who can remember when their fathers went down to the mill in the morning and the men stood around in a circle and the foreman picked out whoever he wanted for that day, and who knows what that worker had to do for the foreman in order to be selected. So, the case for seniority in hiring and promotion, I think, is very strong, very important achievement. But think about layoffs, which, of course, we had to think about here in Youngstown, Ohio, and that's been true of many other manufacturing communities in the country. If you go by strict seniority, if you apply seniority mechanically in a layoff situation, the result is that the most recent hires, who are often women and minorities, get put on the street with nothing, while white males who were not any fault of their own, but because of the nature of our society, were hired before these more recent hires, continue to work full-time and sometimes to pull overtime, which I think is just, a major war crime in the movement trying to create solidarity. And the effect of mechanically applying seniority in layoffs is to destroy community and solidarity. And I have collected examples in the early 30s, in the practice of some CIO local unions not so long ago, in the experience of the legal services office where my wife and I worked. What workers often do spontaneously from below is to say, forget seniority when there's a layoff. We will consider ourselves a family at work, and we will all take the same hit, down to a certain point, of course. But in our legal services office, it meant we will all take 4 days' work rather than 5 days' work, since the president just cut our budget 20%, and we'll do it equally, without regard to when different ones of us first came to work here. And it's that conflict between a culture of solidarity and equality, and a culture in which each person looks out only for himself or herself, that I think is in addition to the structural problems we identified a few minutes ago, it's that conflict within the very soul of the labor movement that has something to do with the sorry state in which it finds itself today.
Well, and just to bring us back to the notion of accompaniment and the book, I think that what you describe as accompaniment, which is essentially, you might call it this might be reductionist, but it's sort of giving up your sense that you know better than the people that you're working with, and joining their community, as opposed to trying to tell people what is better for them, or that, your analysis and your background, your experience is more broad and better, and therefore you can tell people what they need. accompaniment seems to me more of a it's essentially a the notion that there is no such thing as an organizer. There are only, as the word implies, there are people who work together with others, accompany on the journey to wherever it is you're going. But that doesn't, it seems to me, and I know you've in the book kind of pinpointed as coming from Archbishop Romero's experience, and it's carried forward in Paul Farmer's work in Haiti. But it also seems to me to be very reflective of the social elements of the 60s that have carried forward to today in what I see in technology and in the way that the internet and the web have flattened hierarchies, or tried to, not always successfully.
Well, I try to be very careful in talking about the 60s, which I was very much involved in. And on the one hand, pointing out that even in a group as decentralized, as egalitarian as SNCC, I think this organizing mantra had a pernicious effect. On the other hand, there were elements of the 60s that were very much in the spirit of Oscar Romero, and I'm thinking of the early women's movement. I'm thinking also of, by and large, the anti-war movement insofar as it focused on individual young men refusing to commit what they considered war crimes. So it was a mixed heritage in which I think the organizing model was dominant, but not exclusive. And as you say, there may be some connection. I am not myself, I mean, I came along too early to be fully caught up in the new technology and its egalitarian implications, apart from punching in on AOL every morning.
Well,
But I understand what you're talking about, that it appears to be a new way of working together that has some very significant advantages.
well, and I think you bring it to bear in talking about the Occupy movement, because there you see very clearly there's this a kind of rising up from below, as you might call it, but it's the there isn't really a below. It's people who have similar feelings and motivations and understandings coming together without leaders.
Yeah, and let me just say two quick things about Occupy. One, to restate the obvious, I think its core constituency is persons who have completed what they had been told was sufficient education to get a good job and cannot get that job and may as well be loaded down with a really ridiculous and obscene amount of debt for the education that they received. I remember when my wife and I were in Mexico, we ran into people who had been told, "Look, we're going to give you a free university education, but after you graduate, you're going to have to spend a couple of years doing publicly useful things for our society." And we met a young man and his wife in the mountains of Oaxaca, where our daughter was also stationed. They were by no means happy with what they were being required to do, but it seemed to me a much superior arrangement. So those are the occupiers. And the other thing I feel quite strongly is it stands to reason, if you take a moment to reflect, that people weren't going to occupy the central public squares of cities forever. I mean, sooner or later, whether or not nudged by the authorities, occupiers were going to have to move into the experience of trying to define working groups that could, in a day-to-day way, address some of the things that the 1% has inflicted on the 99%. And we're involved in that in Youngstown, where the strongest, what you might call, successor effort to Occupy has been in opposition to fracking of natural gas, but where there are also other smaller offshoots. My wife and I have become educators in one of our local prisons. I've recovered my ability to be a teacher after being blacklisted by the academic profession for my activities in opposition to the Vietnam War. And I feel that this must be happening everywhere there was an Occupy initiative, and that rather than people wringing their hands and saying, oh, look how much smaller we are now and what difficulty we're having in kind of finding our feet again, that's inevitable. And the important thing is to cherish and nurture the working groups that have emerged and see what we can do with them.
Do you think that I guess I was going to ask you about, you know, that how does a group of people come together and figure out a kind of structural way to challenge authority? You know, do you think about that as part of your analysis of how accompaniment works?
Well, I think certainly. I'm sure Youngstown is not the only city where there's a favorite cafe where occupiers hang out, and people say to each other, well, let's put out the word that at 2 o'clock next Tuesday afternoon, those of us who are interested in so-and-so get together. And then, you know, you're at a table with, let's say, 10 to 20 people. You may elect a chairperson of the moment just to help things remain orderly, but the tone of the whole is people sitting around a table and looking into each other's eyes and making decisions together. I don't think that's beyond the wit of ordinary human beings. In fact, I think it's probably pretty obvious. And we just have to proceed in that way, remembering that gardens grow from seeds. And that coming together of 10 or 20 people as equals to decide on what they do together is the process of planting seeds in social change.
Is there for today's social movements, is there anybody, any one thinker, writer, aside from your own book, but you know, who would you point to as if I was, let's say, 25 and I wanted to do stuff, you know, do things, I'm motivated to do something, but I don't know where to start. Who would you recommend that they read to get ideas from? Obviously, interacting with human beings is important, but also I think books have this power to change and motivate and inform. And I'm just kind of curious to know who you would recommend people read.
I think the book I would most recommend is A Spanish Grammar. That is to say, I think that Latin America is that part of the world where the practice of accompaniment has put down deepest roots, perhaps especially in Chiapas, Mexico, but by no means only there. And that really is where I would begin. If you learn Spanish, and I am not fluent in Spanish, but my daughter is, and she now lives in Guatemala, and I think that acquaintance with that world is a good place to begin, and then, read particular books, decide on a particular place, choose a particular profession. But I think if we can somehow get our heads and our hearts outside the United States, and it could be in many other places, of course, Palestine might be a good one, but for my own family and myself, I think Latin America has been that site for apprenticeship.
Oh, that's good. No, I appreciate that. Well, I really love this book. I thought it was very clear, and I really appreciated the kind of the linking together of all of these experiences that you've had, from labor to civil rights, through the anti-war movement of the 60s to liberation theology with Oscar Romero and the prisoner's work, which actually is something we probably didn't have time to talk about a lot, but in this country, the prison system is just unbelievably...
Yeah, and if I could say one more sentence, watch California in July, where there's going to be another hunger strike in its super maximum prisons. And this is not going to be a hunger strike that will be content to call it off after 3 weeks when soothing words are said by hypocritical administrators. It's going to be a very, very serious scene.
Well, I think that is important, and I think I'll refer people who are listening to your book, because I think your discussion about the prison movement is really powerful. I also want just one thing before we're closing. There was one line in this book that I just loved, and I thought it was really important. Society lives with gated imaginations. I thought that was just a perfect description of how we live.
Yeah, that was a phrase that I, for some reason, plucked out of the air when I was asked to be the keynote speaker at the first Occupy gathering here in Youngstown. And you're not the only person who has responded to it.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one, because I think it was really good. Well, I really appreciated talking to you today. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Staudin Lind about his wonderful book, Accompanying: Pathways to Social Change. It's published by PM Press, and you can find it at pmpress.org. Thanks so much, Staudin.
You bet.